were on the washstand, and he helped himself to one. He needed it. He sat on the toilet and smoked, tapping ashes into the sink. An anxiety dream, Donna would have said, and God knew he had enough to be anxious about. Yet he had gone to bed around 10:30 in better spirits than he had been in for the last week. After arriving back at the hotel, he and Roger had spent half an hour in the Ritz-Carlton's bar, kicking the apology idea around. And then, from the bowels of a huge old wallet he hauled around, Roger produced the home number of Yancey Harrington. Harrington was the actor who played the sharp serial professor. "Might as well see if he'll do it before we go any further," Roger said. He had picked up the phone and dialed Harrington, who lived in Westport, Connecticut. Vic hadn't known just what to expect. If pressed for his best guess, he would have said that probably Harrington would have to be stroked a little. He had been just miserable over the Zinger's affair and what he considered it had done to his image. Both of them had been in for a happy surprise. Harrington had agreed instantly. He recognized the realities of the situation and knew the professor was pretty well finished. "Poor old guy's a gone goose," Harrington had said glumly. But he thought the final ad might be just the thing to get the company over the affair. Put it back on the rails, so to speak. "Bullshit," Roger said, grinning after he had hung up. "He just likes the idea of one final curtain call. Not many actors in advertising get a chance like that. He'd buy his own plane ticket to Boston if we asked him to." So Vic had gone to bed happy and had fallen asleep almost instantly. Then the dream. He was standing in front of Tad's closet door in the dream and telling Tad that there was nothing in there, nothing at all. "I'll show you once and for all," he told Tad. He opened the closet door and saw that Tad's clothes and toys were gone. There was a forest growing in Tad's closet, old pines and spruces, ancient hardwoods. The closet floor was covered with fragrant needles and leafy mulch. He had scraped at it, wanting to see if the floor of painted boards was beneath. It wasn't. His foot scraped up rich black forest earth instead. He stepped into the closet, and the door closed behind him. That was all right. There was enough light to see by. He found a trail and began to hike along it. All at once he realized there was a pack on his back and a canteen slung over one shoulder. He could hear the mysterious sound of the wind soughing through the firs and faint bird song. 7 years ago, long before AdWorks, they had all gone hiking on part of the Appalachian Trail during one of their vacations, and that land had looked a good deal like the geography of his dream. They had done it only that once, sticking to the seacoast after that. Vic, Donna, and Roger had had a wonderful time, but Althea Breakstone loathed hiking and had come down with a good, itchy case of poison oak on top of that. The first part of the dream had been rather pleasant. The thought that all this had been right inside Tad's closet was, in its own strange way, wonderful. Then he had come into a clearing, and he had seen... But it was already beginning to tatter, the way dreams do when they are exposed to waking thought. The other side of the clearing had been a sheer gray wall rising maybe 1,000 feet into the sky. About 20 feet up, there was a cave. No, not really deep enough to be a cave. It was more of a niche, just a depression in the rock that happened to have a flat floor. Donna and Tad were cowering inside, cowering from some sort of monster that was trying to reach up and then reach in, get them, eat them. It had been like that scene in the original King Kong, after the great ape has shaken Fay Wray's would-be rescuers from the log and is trying to get the lone survivor, but the guy has gotten into a hole and Kong isn't quite able to get him. The monster in his dream hadn't been a giant ape, though. It had been a... what? Dragon? No, nothing like that. Not a dragon, not a dinosaur, not a troll. He couldn't get it. Whatever it was, it couldn't quite get in and get Donna and Tad, so it was merely waiting outside their bolt hole, like a cat, waiting with dreadful patience for a mouse. He began to run, but no matter how fast he went, he never got any closer to the other side of the clearing. He could hear Donna screaming for help, but when he called back, his words seemed to die 2 feet out of his mouth. It was Tad who had finally spotted him. "They don't work," Tad had screamed in a hopeless, despairing voice that had hollowed out Vic's guts with fear. "Daddy, the monster words don't work. Oh, Daddy, they don't work. They never worked. You lied, Daddy. You lied." He ran on, but it was as if he were on a treadmill, and he had looked at the base of that high gray wall and had seen a heaped drift of old bones and grinning skulls, some of them furred with green moss. That was when he woke up. What had that monster been, anyway? He just couldn't remember. Already the dream seemed like a scene observed through the wrong end of a telescope. He dropped the cigarette into the jar, flushed it, and ran water into the sink as well to swirl the ashes down the drain. He urinated, shut off the light, and went back to bed. As he lay down, he glanced at the telephone and felt a sudden irrational urge to call home. Irrational? That was putting it mildly. It was 2:10 in the morning. He would not only wake her up, he would probably scare the living hell out of her in the bargain. You didn't interpret dreams literally. Everyone knew that. When both your marriage and your business seemed in danger of running off the rails at the same time, it wasn't really surprising that your mind pulled a few unsettling head games, was it? Still, just to hear her voice and know she's okay. He turned away from the telephone, punched up the pillow, and resolutely shut his eyes. Call her in the morning if that'll make you feel better. Call her right after breakfast. That eased his mind, and very shortly he drifted off to sleep again. This time he did not dream. Or if he did, these dreams never imprinted themselves on his conscious mind. And when the wake-up call came on Tuesday, he had forgotten all about the dream of the beast in the clearing. He had only the vaguest recollection of having gotten up in the night at all. Vic did not call home that day. Charity Camber awoke that Tuesday morning on the dot of 5 and went through her own brief period of disorientation. Yellow wallpaper instead of wood walls, colorful green print curtains instead of white chintz, a narrow single bed instead of the double that had begun to sag in the middle. Then she knew where she was, Stratford, Connecticut, and felt a burst of pleased anticipation. She would have the whole day to talk to her sister, to hash over old times, to find out what she had been doing the last few years. And Holly had talked about going into Bridgeport to do some shopping. She had awakened an hour and a half before her usual time, probably 2 hours or more before things began to stir in this household. But a person never slept well in a strange bed until the third night. That had been one of her mother's sayings, and it was a true one. The silence began to give up its little sounds as she lay awake and listening, looking at the thin 5 o'clock light that fell between the half-drawn curtains. Dawn's early light, always so white and clear and fine. She heard the creak of a single board. A blue jay having its morning tantrum. The day's first commuter train bound for Westport, Greenwich, in New York City. The board creaked again. And again. It wasn't just the house settling. It was footsteps. Charity sat up in bed, the blanket and sheet pooling around the waist of her sensible pink nightgown. Now the steps were going slowly downstairs. It was a light tread, bare feet or sock feet. It was Brett. When you lived with people, you got to know the sound of their walk. It was one of those mysterious things that just happen over a course of years, like the shape of a leaf sinking into a rock. She pushed the covers back, got up, and went to the door. Her room opened on the upstairs hall, and she just saw the top of Brett's head disappearing, his cowlick sticking up for a moment, and then gone. She went after him. When Charity reached the top of the stairs, Brett was just disappearing down the hallway that ran the width of the house, from the front door to the kitchen. She opened her mouth to call him, and then shut it again. She was intimidated by the sleeping house that wasn't her house. Something about the way he had been walking, the set of his body. But it had been years since... She descended the stairs quickly and quietly in her bare feet. She followed Brett into the kitchen. He was dressed only in light blue pajama bottoms, their white cotton drawstring hanging down to below the neat fork of his crotch. Although it was barely midsummer, he was already very brown. He was naturally dark, like his father, and tanned easily. Standing in the doorway, she saw him in profile, that same fine, clear morning light pouring over his body as he hunted along the line of cupboards above the stove and the counter and the sink. Her heart was full of wonder and fear. He's beautiful, she thought. Everything that's beautiful or ever was in us is in him. It was a moment she never forgot. She saw her son, clad only in his pajama bottoms, and for a moment dimly comprehended the mystery of his boyhood, so soon to be left behind. His mother's eyes loved the slim curves of his muscles, the line of his buttocks, the clean soles of his feet. He seemed utterly perfect. She saw it clearly because Brett wasn't awake. As a child, there had been episodes of sleepwalking, about 24 of them in all, between the ages of 4 and 8. She had finally gotten worried enough, scared enough, to consult with Dr. Gresham without Joe's knowledge. She wasn't afraid that Brett was losing his mind. Anyone who was around him could see he was bright and normal. But she was afraid that he might hurt himself while he was in that strange state. Dr. Gresham had told her that was very unlikely, and that most of the funny ideas people had about somnambulism came from cheap, badly researched movies. "We only know a little about sleepwalking," he had told her, "but we do know that it is more common in children than it is in adults. There's a constantly growing, constantly maturing interaction between the mind and body, Mrs. Camber, and a lot of people who have done research in this field believe that sleepwalking may be a symptom of a temporary and not terribly significant imbalance between the two." "Like growing pains?" she had asked doubtfully. "Very much like that," Gresham had said with a grin. He drew a bell curve on his office pad, suggesting that Brett's somnambulism would reach a peak, hold for a while, then begin to taper off. Eventually, it would disappear. She had gone away a little reassured by the doctor's conviction that Brett would not go sleepwalking out a window or down the middle of a highway, but without being much enlightened. A week later, she had brought Brett in. He had been just a month or two past his 6th birthday then. Gresham had given him a complete physical and had pronounced him normal in every way. And indeed, Gresham had appeared to be right. The last of what Charity thought of as his night walks had occurred more than 2 years ago. The last, that was, until now. Brett opened the cupboards one by one, closing each neatly before going on to the next, disclosing Holly's casserole dishes, the extra elements to her Gen Air range, her dish towels neatly folded, her coffee and tea creamer, her as-yet-incomplete set of depression glassware. His eyes were wide and blank, and she felt a cool certainty that he was seeing the contents of other cabinets in another place. She felt the old, helpless terror that she had almost completely forgotten, as parents do, the alarms and the excursions of their children's early years, the teething, the vaccination that brought the frighteningly high fever as a little extra added attraction, the croup, the ear infection, the hand or leg that suddenly began to spray irrational blood. "What's he thinking?" she wondered. "Where is he? And why now, after 2 quiet years? Was it being in a strange place? He hadn't seemed unduly upset, at least not until now. He opened the last cupboard and took down a pink gravy boat. He put it on the counter. He picked up empty air and mimed pouring something into the gravy boat. Her arms suddenly broke out in goose flesh as she realized where he was and what this dumb show was all about. It was a routine he went through each day at home. He was feeding Cujo. She took an involuntary step toward him and then stopped. She didn't believe those wives' tales about what might happen if you woke a sleepwalker, that the soul would be forever shut out of the body, that madness might result or sudden death. And she hadn't needed Dr. Gresham to reassure her on that score. She had gotten a book on special loan from the Portland City Library. But she hadn't really needed that either. Her own good common sense told her that what happened when you woke up a sleepwalker was that they woke up. No more and no less than just that. There might be tears, even mild hysteria, but that sort of reaction would be provoked by simple disorientation. Still, she had never wakened Brett during one of his night walks, and she didn't dare to do so now. Good common sense was one thing. Her unreasoning fear was another, and she was suddenly very afraid and unable to think why. What could be so dreadful in Brett's acted-out dream of feeding his dog? It was perfectly natural. As worried as he had been about Cujo. He was bent over now, holding the gravy boat out, the drawstring of his pajama trousers making a right-angled white line to the horizontal plane of the red and black linoleum floor. His face went through a slow-motion pantomime of sorrow. End of side five. To continue, turn the cassette over.